Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with a continual update. I mean, it seems like we've been on a lot lately, folks, but that's because there's a lot to talk about. And we've had three hurricanes hit in rapid succession to the U.S. mainland and U.S. Caribbean islands, and it's time to continue to focus on the aftermath of what happens when you respond to these things, as well as talk about the ongoing challenges down there. So without much further ado, let's go ahead and bring Sam on. And Sam, are you about to disappear from us again?
I am. I just found that out this morning, and it's not what I was expecting to do. They actually have me backfilling on a team that's going down into one of the austere environments. I'm not sure exactly where yet. But it's kind of cool because it's a sister team to my team, and I know a lot of people on the team, and so it'll be enjoyable seeing some of my California friends. So it'll be interesting and much different. I mean, the last two deployments, I sat in hotels most of the time. This is going to be a very different experience. So what I want to know from Kyle Nelson is what to expect down there in terms of weather. Is there any other hurricanes going to sneak up on us and rain on us or blow us away or whatever?
Well, Sam, thankfully, nothing on the current outlook from the National Hurricane Center set to impact any of the areas that you could potentially be deployed to down there in the Caribbean. So as far as current update, a little closer to home, Hurricane Maria is about 200 miles east of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and is going to slowly start moving off to the east, out into the open ocean, and away from the U.S. mainland. The only remaining tropical system in the Atlantic is Hurricane Lee, which poses no threat whatsoever to the U.S. or its territories. Looking ahead, Jamie and I were talking about this in the pre-show, but there is an area of storms just south of Cuba currently that the National Hurricane Center is watching closely. It's not expected to develop into a organized tropical system. However, it will likely produce locally heavy rainfall over Cuba, southern Florida, Florida Keys, and the Bahamas over the next several days. Looking closer to home here in the lower 48, the severe weather scene has been quite quiet here. But however, it is a tale of two air masses. In the central and eastern U.S., the air you can wear returned with a vengeance this past week, high temperature records being broken for several days in a row, including today in many parts of the Northeast. And that's expected to continue next week, but not to the level that it has been, thankfully. Rain and snow will continue in the western U.S. in the mountains, and fall is in full effect for us here in the western U.S. So that's it for the weather update. Back to you.
Boy, it sure has. I mean, we went from one 84-degree day. Today it was 58, and it's kind of stayed in that fall pattern. So welcome to Colorado. So Dr. Joe, what's your status as far as deployments? Are you going to stick around for a while, or are you still potentially going to go out, or what's going on?
I am very pleased to be back home in Memphis for the first time in almost a month. So it's been a very hectic several weeks. You know, I guess I'm on alert for anything ongoing in Puerto Rico, although it sounds like the teams that we have there now are going to be adequate to take care of the search and rescue job. So I don't anticipate anything else at this point.
Okay, well, maybe that's good. I'm not sure how long we'll be gone, but it'll be at least a couple weeks probably, so we'll have to figure things out. So Joe, you know, being as I'm going into a very austere environment, and we had questions from some of our listeners that are on NGOs that maybe don't have as much training and experience as the federal employees do. There's a couple things that have come up, and one of those things is kind of what to expect on a deployment in terms of health, how to prepare yourself for that, what kind of immunizations one should get going in. Can you touch on that for us?
Well, I'll be glad to. You know, they're two sort of different but related issues. You know, I think from an immunization standpoint, the things that you need to be protected from especially if you know, you're working in floodwaters, et cetera, are things that are transmitted via the sort of fecal oral route, which is you know, being exposed to contaminated foods and water and that sort of stuff. So the ones that spring to mind immediately are hepatitis, especially hepatitis A, but hepatitis B as well. So ensuring that those immunizations are up to date, I think, is vitally important. Some of the really simple ones like tetanus and you know, influenza sound fairly mundane and routine, but you know, in those environments, the transmission of those diseases is often quite accelerated due to the change in habitat to the vector, the mosquito or the tick or whatever else is out there, and the large influx of people into an environment that are not usually there. So those things in combination can really put folks at risk for a lot of preventable significant diseases that, that I think it's vitally important that people not show up to those events without those kind of things being taken care of.
Oh, really good point. We do tend to take tetanus for, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, I better go check my tetanus. As far as the people that are living within these disaster areas and have been now for several weeks, Jamie sent us a really interesting article about a 77-year-old woman that died from the flesh-eating disease. And there was also a rescuer that was affected by that who fortunately did survive. And it seems like if you even have a lesion as small as a mosquito bite, this kind of thing can happen. Can you talk about that?
Well, I'll be glad to. You know, I let me back up, though, just a little bit and sort of talk about some broader things that have a big impact on diseases like that. And, you know, again, since it's all been hurricanes and floods, pretty much except for the disaster in the earthquake in Mexico here recently, you know, most of the exposures there are related to water in some way or another. And I think when you look at the history of major flooding in major metropolitan areas and, you know, flooding related to hurricanes, et cetera, I think what you have to appreciate is that most of the water that you are being exposed to is basically sewage. It's full of all kinds of bad stuff, including direct sewage itself. And in many cases, it's also contaminated with a variety of chemicals and petroleum products. So, you know, especially along the Gulf Coast, where most of the hurricanes have been pretty impactful, there's a large number of petroleum refineries there. And obviously, that's where a lot of our petroleum industry is based. And so the, you know, the damage to those plants that subsequently causes a leak of some sort of petroleum into the water table can be pretty devastating and very toxic to rescuers. So having said that, I think that people tend to have a relatively blasé approach to being exposed to those waters and really feel like it's, well, the river overflowed, so it's just river water and I play in the river all the time. What's the big deal? That's often not the case. And so we see a lot of people who are exposed to floodwaters because they are improperly dressed, because they're, you know, personal home is flooded. They're out involved in their community trying to help out and are being exposed to those waters. And that sort of goes on to the other issues that you were talking about. So we're tending to be in fairly austere conditions. Power's out, so air conditioning's not working. So the windows are open to be cooler when you're trying to sleep, which leaves you as mosquito bait, basically. And so, you know, the ability to get bit by multiple different insects or larger insects like spiders and snakes and things like that that have all been displaced from their habitat is significantly greater. And while something as insignificant as a insect bite might not be a big deal under normal circumstances, when you are subsequently kind of bathing that irritated insect bite, you keep scratching with water that contains sewage and petrochemicals and all kinds of stuff, that the chances for significant irritation and inoculation with all kinds of pretty nasty germs becomes much more much easier to occur and much more likely to occur.
And I think that that really is probably one of the things that, that scares a lot of people the most. And they didn't think, they don't think about it, but we've talked about it since we've seen the footage from Houston and people from Harvey, just, you know, with their whole families wading down the street, not realizing what's in that water. And then, of course, the continual exposure for the responders and the civilian responders, especially, who probably aren't vaccinated against all these things. It can be quite a challenge, I would think, after the fact for a public health system.
Well, there's no question about it, Jamie. You know, the we work very hard on the in the USAR world to sort of assess the threat. With what diseases are likely in this area, and what diseases are likely in the environment that we are in, and to provide recommendations and personal protective equipment that's appropriate to try to minimize those exposures as much as we can. And then that follows along with the kind of diseases, that's not the right word, the kind of symptoms that we often see in rescuers who are working in those environments, and what the post deployment sort of screening and monitoring ought to look like. So, for example, as an incident support team doc, one of my jobs is to be sort of continuously assessing what's going on with multiple different teams and watching for certain trends and being aware that there may be certain things that from a follow-up standpoint, we're going to need to continue to monitor or look at more closely, et cetera.
Joe, in a previous answer to that gal's question, you also mentioned Zika, dengue, and a word I can't pronounce. chikungunya.
Oh, that's good, Sam. Chikungunya. You're right.
Oh, did I get it right? Okay. Wow. Sounded it out. Okay.
Sounds like a hen with a pistol.
Anyway, you know, can you speak to those just a little bit?
Sure. Those are all, dengue fever and Rocky Mountain spotted fever and many of those vector-borne illnesses that are transmitted to humans either through ticks or mosquitoes can be a problem. And you know, in most cases, what we see in these major events, especially a big hurricane, is that in the first few days after the hurricane passes through, it essentially is sort of blown away most of those mosquitoes and all that. I mean, we don't see a lot of birds around. We don't see a lot of insects around for several days. And it's literally because they've sort of been blown away and their breeding and feeding habitats have been substantially disrupted. But at the same time, within a few days, especially in an area that's inundated with flooding, there are many, many, many new areas of standing water that make for great breeding zones. And obviously the food sources are pretty substantial at that point for insects and snakes and ticks and all kinds of stuff. So we tend to see those type of exposures coming on after a few days in an environment like that. And part of the other issue that we see is that in many cases, animals that provide food for fleas and ticks and mosquitoes have been driven out of their habitat, which often is far away from people, into areas where it's dry, and therefore they're now being exposed to people. So you know, the convenience factor of putting all those things together means that the possibilities of transmission of those diseases at certain times during those deployments can be higher. And so we look for symptomatology that may be related to those diseases, and we follow our people up to ensure that if they come home and develop, you know, some sort of vague flu-like illness, that they get properly screened for all those different possible disease processes so that we can be sure that they're taken care of like they need to be. So I think that's one of the other things I worry a lot about with especially sort of lay rescuers who try to do the right thing by, you know, grabbing their fishing boat and coming down to the hurricane and putting their boat in the water and going around and rescuing people. And in many cases, they haven't thought too much about the incredible importance of stuff as simple as insect repellent and taking good care of their feet so that they don't get blisters, and having proper protective equipment so that they don't get cuts and scrapes, which just gives the bacteria in the environment an easier access into your bloodstream. And it, from my limited knowledge of the couple of cases of flesh-eating disease that you described earlier, which is called necrotizing fasciitis, where you have an organism that invades the body and gets into the deep tissues and tends to track along those tissue planes and grows quite aggressively. You know, before those patients are really very symptomatic, they have an overwhelming bacterial infection that just is late to be apparent, and that makes treatment of those folks very challenging and often not aggressive enough early on, because you simply don't recognize that that's what's happening until it's very, very apparent, and by then you're pretty far down the road. So in folks who have other disease processes going on, for example, they're diabetic or have vascular disease or whatever, you know, those people can get quite sick and pretty far down that road before the severity of the infection is very apparent. And that often leads to a bad outcome, as it certainly did in the case that you described earlier. So, you know, those are kind of things that I think people have to pay really close attention to. It sounds very minor, and I don't want to be bitten by, you know, mosquitoes because I hate having to scratch, and how uncomfortable would that be while I'm trying to work? That's all legit, but it's also related to, you know, the more you scratch with crap under your fingernails and, you know, abrading your skin and allowing bacterial invasion of the skin because you're not in the right PPE, or you've been wet all day and you didn't think anything about being wet all day, or you don't appreciate that you're wet because you've been standing in a sewer all day. You know, those kind of things I think people don't tend to think much of. And that's why those disease processes get quite a leg up in these disasters, because people are not paying attention to the really simple basic stuff when they're out there in those environments.
Well, and that also gives me a clue of what kind of patients are likely to see this far into this incident. Kyle, you had a question.
Yeah, Joe, I'm curious to get your thoughts. Some of the folks that respond to disaster environments, they may be pretty kind of maybe on like the prepper side. They're pretty savvy, and perhaps they bring their own supply of different medications, which may include antibiotics. I'd like to get your thoughts on that with regard to as kind of self-treating and self-medicating in the field, and what dangers that might pose.
Wow, that's a really great question, Kyle, and I bet we could do a 3-hour podcast on that, honestly. I think the issue with that is I think there is value in being able to initiate treatment in the field and that can certainly include antibiotics. I think that the downside there is you need to be savvy enough to ensure that you are choosing the right antibiotic for the likely organism that's causing the disease you're trying to treat. Because, you know, for example, if you started yourself on an antibiotic for, a skin infection, many of those antibiotics are pretty good for organisms like staph and strep, which are certainly very common in skin infections. But, you know, in an environment where there's sewage and toxic chemicals and all that sort of stuff, the incidence of more unusual organisms is higher. And therefore, all the antibiotic may do is kill off the 80% of the infection that happens to be sensitive to the antibiotic, leaving you with the 20% that was resistant to that antibiotic, and allowing it to, you know, take off and run, which subsequently leads to a bad outcome. So I think it's much more than just having access to the antibiotics. I think it's important that you understand the medicine and that you understand the infectious disease process and that you understand the likely organisms that you're being exposed to, and an appreciation that there are consequences and side effects to those medications that can be worse than the thing you first thought you were treating, and that those side effects may actually be a whole lot worse for you than whatever thing it was you thought you were treating in the first place. So, you know, I think the other thing that it reminds me of is that in virtually all of these major flood / hurricane events, the medical care there always sees people who have upper respiratory type illnesses and symptoms of cough and runny nose and congestion and all that kind of stuff. We see a lot of skin issues, whether that's rash or sunburn or blisters or questionable infectious processes on the skin. And it's simply not uncommon to see that, and it takes a bit of an experienced eye to appreciate that that's not something that necessarily ought to get antibiotics, and that, you know, many of those, especially the respiratory illnesses, are related to the fact that we've stirred up a whole bunch of germs and viruses and fungi and spores and pollens and all kinds of stuff that have been dormant for years that are now all stirred up in the environment, and we're coming in from someplace else where we don't normally get exposed to that. So 3 or 4 days of exposure to that environment, and you're coughing and sniffling, and you know, you have a cold and you think you have bronchitis and you need some antibiotics, when in reality that's just simply sort of an allergic or immunologically based response to, a particle that your body's not used to being exposed to. So while I think the use of antibiotics can be very appropriate, I hope that people understand that there's a lot more to it than just, I've got a bottle of some antibiotics I had left over from the last time I had a sore throat, and I'm going to take those with me and I'm going to use those. Because I've seen at least as many problems from that approach as I have benefit.
Wow, good question and great answer. Thanks, Joe. As we wind this up here, and obviously we could talk about this a long time, let's talk about prevention. What can people do, and I'm thinking of myself here, to really bolster our immune systems as responders going into a deployment, or just for people in general that need to bolster their immune systems, because I think that would help keep us getting from some of these things. that we need antibiotics for.
Sure. Well, again, another really great question, Sam. And I don't know that I necessarily, you know, sort of know the secret to bolstering your immune system as much as sort of working on the other side of that equation, which is what can I do to not negatively impact my immune system while I'm doing this kind of work. So it's not in the least uncommon. As a matter of fact, I think it's probably normal for folks who are responding in those kind of environments to be working at an intense pace, dehydrated, poorly fed, very poorly slept, and completely off their sort of normal routine. So I think an appreciation for the intense physiologic stress related to disaster response, and, you know, on top of that, the psychological stress of being away from home and seeing things that are not very pretty, and you know, I mean, you get the good side of I'm helping people, but, you know, it's not all, you know, clowns and unicorns. So, you know, I think you have to be very aware that those things are all working against you, and that your sleep cycle is going to be disrupted, and you're not going to be sleeping well because you're hot and you're on the concrete or, you know, wherever you are trying to do this work, and that you're outside of your normal environment, and I forgot to bring all my medicines with me, and I'm eating, you know, MREs or the donuts that the Red Cross keeps bringing over, and you know, it's just before you know it, you're two or three days into one of those events, and you are sort of physically and immunologically worn down pretty hard, which just simply makes the ability to fight off something that wouldn't bother you much, much more challenging. So, you know, I think the ways to sort of maintain your immune system are to work really hard to take care of yourself, to make certain that you've got the right personal protective equipment, that you're doing the best you can to try to get as good a quality sleep as you can get. You're trying to watch what you're eating. You're trying not to get dehydrated. You're careful about your own PPE and decontamination. You know, you're not throwing all your stuff off on your sleeping bag and then crawling in there at night and breathing all that stuff in all night long. You know, you have to be a little bit particular about all that stuff, and you have to be a little bit OCD about making certain that you're not bringing bad stuff back into an environment that you're trying to keep clean. And that apart from the really simple stuff of I don't want to sleep around all this really nasty, smelly stuff, there are disease processes at work that, you know, you need some time away from just to allow your body an opportunity to respond and defend against those things. So, you know, I would just stress to people that it's important to take care of yourself. As we've talked about before, it's certainly important to make sure that you have your immunizations up to date, that you are appropriately responding to a blister on your foot or a scrape on your hand, and that you're cleaning that area and you're trying to protect it from further exposure. And, you know, you're not just sort of blowing that off, because it can come back and bite you quite hard.
Literally. Thank you, Joe. That's an amazing amount of information in a very short period of time, and I will take that to heart. So, Jamie, again, Dr. Joe has enlightened us to a lot of things we may or may not have known, but it's very specific to this thing we're dealing with right now, which is this disaster. Nothing better than good training and good education from Dr. Joe.
Absolutely. And, you know, Joe, it's one of those things. I know that responders and organization, you know, professional organizations that work with the federal government, like the USAR teams, the DMATs and things like that, all train and prepare and talk about these kind of things with their responders before deployment and during training. But, you know, the responders in place in communities where these disasters happen may not get that kind of training. And I think that's one of the reasons why Paragon Medical Education Group is so important, to come in and provide the necessary education that people need from responders who've been through the process. And I think that's something you guys do so well.
Well, I appreciate that, Jamie. You know, I think that is one of the things that really sets us apart is, you know, all of our instructors and all of our people are folks who are actually out there doing the job. And that's just basically a criteria. If you want to work with us, you got to have the experience to back up the education that you're providing. So that's a very important piece to us. And I think something that folks don't think too much about with disaster training in general.
So if somebody wants to have Paragon come in or just, you know, just chat with you guys to see if there's a way that to bring you in or what kind of services they might be able to find within your organization, where can they reach you?
Well, you can reach us through our website at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can find us on Facebook at ParagonMedicalGroup.com, and you can always reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast. We would highly encourage folks to give us a call. It's very customizable education, and it's virtually impossible on the website to sort of give you the whole picture because there's so many things that can be changed and altered and added to suit the needs of our clients.
And I can second that. Just having seen the variety of different things I've seen you do at various conferences, and I know Sam can attribute can talk about that as well. It's just a lot of customized content that I never expected to see at a conference, and just was amazed by.
Yeah, we'll look forward to what you're going to be doing at EMS Expo next month, Joe. I know you got some things going on there.
We do have a couple of very cool things that we'll be doing related to our CPR education and research, and learned about some new things actually on a big conference call today. So pretty exciting stuff happening in the cardiac arrest world that we're very excited about. Other than that, we're just glad to be back from Bogota, Colombia, and nice to be back in the good old USA.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me there, chat weather, emergency management, or any topic. I'm always happy to continue the conversation.
And Sam, I know you might be in an austere environment yet to be named, but if they were able to reach out to you and you were to respond, where would that be?
Well, you could find me on the social medias, as Kyle said, under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, disasterpodcast.com website, and on our Facebook page on Facebook. So I'm sure I'm hoping we'll get some good communication going on there. What about you, Jamie?
Well, I'm under the handle PodMedic on most social media channels, so look me up, friend, or follow me there. And, of course, our Facebook group over on the Facebook. You can go ahead and reach out to us. Just search Disaster Podcast and ask to join the group, and we'd be happy to let you in and join the conversation there. We'd love to hear from you. And, of course, always at disasterpodcast.com. You know, Sam, we talk a lot about what we do to manage patients and people needing rescue in a disaster situation. But this is an important topic as well, and looking at the medical aspects that affect the responders themselves.
Certainly is, especially when I'm one of them and I'm going into that environment. So as much as I'm looking forward to it, there's, you know, some healthy fear there too. So I appreciate everything Joe had to say. But as I will find out in the next few weeks, disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.